You're listening to the CEO Series with Carl Moore on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
Welcome to the CEO Series. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University. Each week, the CEO Series takes you inside the minds and lives of some of Canada and the world's top leaders to discuss strategy, leadership, and today's pressing issues. And some of the world's top leaders have spent time with us, like Justin Trudeau, Muhammad Yunus, Nobel Peace Prize winner, and Sir Richard Branson. This show gives you a thin, well, perhaps not so thin slice, the kind of thoughtful leaders leading some of today's more interesting organizations. Today, I'm delighted to be speaking with Lieutenant General Jenny Carignan, the first Chief of Professional Conduct and Culture, a newly created position in the Canadian Armed Forces. Lieutenant, that's very different than the American, who is Lieutenant.
Yes, that's correct.
I guess growing up with a Hollywood diet, I'm used to lieutenant rather than lieutenant. So something I've had to learn, I'll share with other people. General, tell us about your early years. Where did you grow up and what did your family do back when you were young?
Yeah, thanks, Dr. Moore, for having me joining your session. It's a pleasure to join you for this one. I grew up in a small mining town called Val des Sources in the Eastern Township. So, you know, we small village, small town where we had lots of activities, camping in the forest. A lot of that was my family activities, pretty much. Yes.
Okay, what did your family do for a living?
So my father was a policeman and my mother was a teacher in primary school. So it was a family of four children, so with brothers and sisters. So no, I had a very normal and happy childhood.
I interviewed Brian Mulroney, the former prime minister, a couple of weeks ago. And it was, again, you know, from small town Quebec, six kids, as I recall, you know, and, you know, good jobs, but nothing, you know, they were not at the level of a general. So it's your brothers and sisters, are they still in that part of Quebec or have they moved on to other parts of the country or the world?
No, both of my brothers still live in Val des Sources, and I have a sister close by Montreal. So, Okay. Well, pretty much all in the same area still.
Okay, very nice to hear that. Jenny, clearly you are a leader today as a lieutenant general. When did you first say to yourself, maybe I'm a leader?
I think I probably had the first experience in grade six. Really, I was a school dropout. I decided to quit school in grade six because the climate in my classroom had become toxic. The teacher was basically not managing discipline in the classroom in a proper way, so it became very difficult for any learning to take place. And all of a sudden, I would pick up fights with boys in the classroom. And on a Friday afternoon, I decided I had enough. So I left with two other classmates of mine. And we started to do schools ourselves in my basement at the house. And the difficulty there was that my mother was a teacher in the same school. So you can just imagine the dynamics at home and at school for her. But I only came back when they replaced the teacher.
Wow.
So this is kind of a time when I started to understand that maybe there's ways of doing, you know, things that where I have a little bit of influence.
That took a fair bit of courage to stand up to that, you know, really huge difference in authority between you and an adult teacher. So that's very impressive. When did you decide to go in the military and attracted you to the Canadian military?
Well, I think like any young adult, you're thinking of what you want to do later in life. You're trying to project maybe a few years ahead of time and see where you could see yourself. Definitely didn't see myself in the military. Like, I don't have a military family. But I heard about the military college, and I thought that the leadership program, the academics, the paid education, the sports program, as well as bilingualism, because I learned English at the military college, because I couldn't speak any English at all prior to joining the military. So I thought this was a great opportunity to have a challenging environment and potentially do something bigger than myself.
Did you consider university, or was it really, which institution did you go? Was it the one in Saint-Jean-de-Richelieu?
No, initially, actually, I was at the college, at the civilian college in Sherbrooke. So I was attending a CGEP in Sherbrooke. So I did 1 year post-secondary, and then during my year there, I, you know, again, decided to try something different. So I went directly to Royal Military College in Kingston from Sherbrooke.
So do you major in things at Kingston, or is it a standard one vanilla approach?
Well, there's many different programs offered at the military colleges. I went into engineering, so I studied chemical engineering while I was at RMC.
Did you qualify as an engineer where you can wear
yes.
the ring
yes.
on your pinky?
Yes.
Do you
yes.
still do that, or is that?
Well, I kind of don't wear a lot of rings to start with. I'm not a person that likes, but I did wear it for a long time. But I gotta, you know, potentially find it in my boxes somewhere.
For Canadians who don't know, why do Canadian engineers, and it's unique in the world, I believe, wear a little ring on their pinky finger? Why is that?
It's a reminder of our duty to serve the public. The ring was originally made up of a bridge that had collapsed because the design was not right. So it's a reminder of our duty to serve the public and act in an ethical fashion.
That's certainly very military, is service, is central to military. Why does that appeal to you?
Again, there's probably some intuitive or intuition that plays into that. Mm. I was attracted initially by a challenge. I was attracted by what the program had to offer. I think there was a sense of also what was important to me was growth. Professionally, I wanted to be able to develop over time, and also personally. So I think this is what attracted me initially. And as you're brought into the military family, then you see that it is much broader than probably the initial perception that you have of the military.
So you call it a family. Why is that?
It is a family. It is a family. We work very closely with others in teams. Like everything we do it in teams, a bit like anything in life, really. You know, if you have a family, you have to work as a team with your family. It's also a sense of identity. It's also a sense of belonging to a greater good, an honorable role in service of Canada yeah. and Canadians. A lot of that also has to do with how dynamic situations can get, because sometimes no 2 days are the same. One day you might be coming into work, but then there's a flood, so you gotta deploy and go help with flood, with pandemics, that's at home here, or any crisis that can arise in the world where your services are required, because we have a very special skill sets that nobody else can do.
I see you have 3 stars on your collar. What does that mean? What else is on your collar?
What we have on the collar are gorgets, and those are worn by colonels and above, so senior okay. executive officers and above. And they are, I guess, traditionally the gorgets was what protected the les chevaliers, the knight's neck as they were fighting in big armor. So these are like, I guess, remnants of that tradition.
So the three stars, like I should have noticed, but like having one star as a general, so like that's very few. How many people in the Canadian military have three stars, roughly?
I think there's about 10 or 12 of us.
So it's a very small number.
It's a very small number, yes.
So when you go around, people kind of, you see people staring at and go, wait a minute, she's really a senior general. You get that reaction some?
For those who know the military, because some people have no idea either, but yes, for those who understand the ranks, yes, of course.
Do people salute you, military people?
Yes, like everybody at a lower rank salutes the higher ranking officers.
So there's only one person you have to salute.
Yes,
one
correct.
There's one 4-star general, as I recall.
Correct.
So that must have taken some getting used to, because after years of saluting people, all of a sudden you just walk down and everybody salutes you. But I guess, you know, it took years to get there anyway.
Yes, and looking back also, this is something that I never saw coming either.
Yeah.
Over time, you realize, oh my goodness, it's 36 years and, you know, I've done this for most of my adult life now.
Yeah.
So it comes a bit at, you know, as a surprise. Time has gone extremely fast.
Yeah. Today, I'm delighted to be speaking with Lieutenant General Jenny Carignan, the first Chief of Conduct and Culture of the Canadian Armed Forces. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and you're listening to the CO Series. Next up, we'll ask General Carignan about her role in conduct and culture. What exactly is that?
Top-notch insight from proven leaders. This is the CEO Series with Carl Moore on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
Hello again, you're listening to the CEO Series, and today I'm speaking with Lieutenant General Jenny Carignan, the first Chief of Conduct and Culture at the Canadian Armed Forces. What, you're the Chief of Professional Conduct and Culture, I believe the first one. What exactly does a Chief of Professional Conduct and Culture do?
So we created that organization in April of 2021. So it's a year and a half old right now.
Mm-hmm.
And this come with the realization that over the many past years, we have built and changed over time in terms of leadership, how we address misconduct, how we address sexual misconducts. But it came to a point last spring when we assessed that we had not gone where we needed to go. And we had a lot of entities within defense that worked culture. So diversity and inclusion, anti-racism, the complaint system, Director General, like the whole gender-based analysis. We have, you know, people who do that. But these many entities did not work in a synchronized and a coordinated fashion because they were spread around our system. So this is what we've done basically is consolidate all of these organizations that have been working culture for many years. And now we are modifying how we interact with the rest of the Canadian Forces and the Department of Defense. So think about CPCC as this platform that constantly monitors change and transformation in our environments. Think about CPCC as the organization that constantly monitors and remain vigilant about work climate and environment.
So that's been something that the military wrestled with for a long time. I guess you saw it yourself during your long career. So this is a significant and an important change because there's just so much more diversity within the ranks of the military than a generation ago.
Yes, so there is a lot of progress that has been made over time, but if we are back at, you know, handling and managing sexual misconducts, this is clearly a symptom that we have not gotten to the root cause of the issue. So now we are going and even more depth, looking at what is the culture that allows for these misconducts to take place. We also understand that this is not just about misconduct, that we have to modernize our system, we have to modernize our manners, we have to modernize the way we train and the way we lead. Why? Because people do change. People are expecting different things from the workplace. And we know, and there's a lot of studies that actually demonstrates that there are more effective ways of leading and achieving objectives as part of an organization. So this is much more than managing misconducts. This has a lot to do with modernizing our way of conducting and interacting with each other.
So in some ways, EDI is a big thing at universities in the corporate world. So I imagine you kind of looked a bit, what are they doing in the corporate world? But knowing the military, you probably took it to a better place in a way. This may be an unfair question to ask you, but what can the rest of the world learn about EDI and things like that from the experience of the Canadian military? What are one or two things that particularly struck you that the rest of us should learn from potentially as well?
Mm-hmm. So I think we can learn a lot from the power of consulting, reaching out, have a deliberate way where you constantly relook at how you conduct your business and what are the best practices out there. So I think this is one piece of it. I would say that the other part in the military is we do a very good job of developing people, not only professionally, but also personally. And develop people over the course of their careers in different occupations, in different contexts, in different jobs, different tasks, different mission. So we have a capacity to develop very well-rounded people who can then continue to contribute to society even, you know, after their military careers.
So something where in your long career you've had a number of different challenges to make you help you grow as a person. And that's partly why you're a three-star today, because you took those opportunities to grow. Take us through a couple of the things that were quite different assignments that you had in your career. Because I recall one time you were in Iraq.
Mm-hmm. Correct. Yes, and it starts with smaller projects. Like I remember being terrified at the first projects I was given as a young officer, and I wasn't sure I would be able to actually do this. But then you have a family around you that can mentor, where you can ask questions. Have you done this before? What does this look like? So you don't get thrown with being the commander of NATO mission Iraq, like right at the beginning. So there's a very deliberate way in terms of giving people experience at the level they are at and challenges, and then move on, you know, to bigger ones as you grow and get more experience and more comfortable. So yes, the Iraq mission in particular was particularly difficult. And I have to say that I used the full 30 some odd years of experience behind me to deal and navigate through that very complex space.
How long were you in Iraq? And what was your mission there?
So a year. I was in Iraq for a full year. And the mission was what we call a security sector reforms, where you train Iraqi soldiers, but you also work at the defense level, at the strategic level, to advise the chief of defense staff or the lead civilian public servant in their defense. You are embedded with the defense machinery to help them better manage whether it's force development, budgeting, fighting corruptions. These are all big strategic complex problems where NATO brought in a bunch of experts via this mission to enable this. Because training strictly at the tactical level does not enable them to do it on their own. So this, in the end, that's what security sector reforms mission are there for.
So sharing some of your wisdom and experience and that of other people to help them get ready for their missions.
Based on their requirement and based on what they assess their priorities were, because of course they are the ones managing their defense. But we could broaden expertise to support and enable their priorities and where they wanted to go.
How big is the military, the Canadian military? How many soldiers?
So total, the Department of National Defense is roughly about 130,000 strong. That's including public service employees. That's including the reserves. That's also including the Rangers, who are mostly deployed in northern Canada, and the regular force.
Today, I'm delighted to be speaking with Lieutenant General Jenny Carignan, the first Chief of Conduct and Culture at the Canadian Armed Forces. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and you're listening to the CO Series. Next up, we'll ask the General about crisis management and what the military does for Canada.
Exclusive access to some of the most successful leaders out there. This is the CEO Series with Carl Moore on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
Hello again, you're listening to the CEO Series, and today I'm speaking with Lieutenant General Jenny Carignan, the first Chief of Conduct and Culture of the Canadian Armed Forces.
So when we think of military, we think of war, but that's really been a small part of your career. So it's much more complex what the military does for Canada. What are some of the other big tasks that come to mind that the military does for our country other than war, thankfully?
So the military prepares always for the worst case scenario of which war is, which means that in preparing for war, you are developing a specific skill sets and competences that nobody else has. So that allows us to become we can employ us in multi different ways, and mostly when we're talking about crisis management. So when there's a crisis, regardless of the crisis, we come in with people who can adapt to the context, with people who can deploy to very difficult places, with people who can assess, make recommendations, work with the civilian authorities, whether it's provincial or others, so we can come in to support to the police or regardless of what it is. So the way we are also organized enables this to happen. So we are organized in a very hierarchical way, and this is important because it is the best. Again, recalling my MBA studies, yeah. There is no perfect structure in an organization. Some do better in some contexts than others. But when we're talking about intervening in a crisis situation, hierarchical organizations are best enabled to do that because then communication systems, everybody knows what they have to do and so on and so forth. But it doesn't mean that people blindly do whatever. You know, we have a lot of people who think, we have a lot of people who take initiatives, and then the way you operate together is what makes the big difference. So, we have a very wide variety of roles that we can be employed to, but it's because of those special skill sets that we acquire because we train for worst-case scenarios.
During COVID, the military is very involved, particularly in Quebec, I recall, in our part of the country. So that's one example of kind of the things the military would do that
it's really helpful to have the hierarchy and the ability to give orders and learn at the same time. So it's an emergent strategy approach where there's orders given, but then if you say, well, General, actually, there's something here, you would listen with great respect and change based on the input you got from there. So it's not just all saluting and taking orders by any means.
No, and unfortunately, I think this is kind of the image that, sir, yes, sir, type of thing. When we have cohort sessions, it is really a cohort. Like, what do you see? Like, what is your read? What do you see in your area? How can we do better? Where do we need to send more people? What's the priority? So all of that work happens, and we do that in a very disciplined way. People understand what the capacity of their own organization is. So when we bring this diversity of people around the table, we need to take it from various experts, and then we design the best possible plan. So again, it's not just about giving orders. It's all about understanding the context, understanding what your folks can do, understanding what the issues, what the challenges are, and then come up with the best possible solution.
I taught with at Duke General Martin Dempsey, who became the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. One of the things he said to me, I interviewed him in his office in the Pentagon, which is a huge office when you're the chair, and he said, generals fight the battles of their youth, is a famous saying in the military. The idea is that when you were young, you were taught by men and women that had been in Vietnam or something, and they taught you about war, and then you learned certain things. Then you went to different military circumstances like Iraq. So in some ways, what he's saying is that you got to put away the lessons of when you were younger in today's world. Does that make sense to you?
I think you need to have a clear, like, if it's a lessons learned, it needs to be learned. But it needs to be adapted to the context that you are facing. Like, what has changed? What is different today than it was back then? Because you just can't cut and paste, an operation that was done 20 years ago and expect, the same result. And when we evolve, when we evolve in a context when it's humans against humans, you can have the same input once. And if you try it twice, you'll have two different outputs. Mm. So we need to absolutely draw on lessons learned of the past. This is why studying philosophy, studying history, studying sociology, understanding the culture, when you piece all of that together, it gives you for a very, very complex set of factors that you need to consider as you go in and design some kind of solution. But I think the trick after that is to be able to adapt to what the effect of, what you're doing, what's the effect, and then constantly in an iterative fashion, adapt to the environment.
Well, I think business needs to do that, absolutely, these days. Generation Z, I just finished a book on them, so I know the theory anyway. Are they different, the Zs that are in the military, as opposed to the boomers and the Xers and so on? Is there a generational difference in your mind?
I think, first of all, I think they are brilliant. I think they are absolutely brilliant. I constantly stay in touch with the military college. I did sit last fall in classrooms with students, and figuring out the context, asking difficult questions. In terms of differences, they feel more comfortable asking questions maybe than we were. And I sense also the importance of work-life balance, which maybe I didn't feel in my, younger years as a young officer. So what's important to them may be a bit different than what was important to us at the time. But I think this is very refreshing. And I think we need to provide them the space to have that need responded to. So I have to say, like, when I look at mine or many of my colleagues' experience, we have a lot of support in the military that maybe we don't find anywhere else. We have family resource centers, we have parental leave, we have support, medical support. We have a lot of that embedded into our own system. So I think there is a lot available there for Generation Z to thrive. Developing our folks is also critically important to us because we want them to be the best that they can be, both professionally and personally as well. So I think this is all very good news. I have kids in the Generation Z space as well, mm-hmm. and like I'm always amazed at the level of consciousness and perception that they have.
So do they reverse mentor you? So you mentor them as their, you know, as their the general, but also as their mother in this case. But do they reverse mentor you and teach you at times?
I learn a lot. I learn a lot both from my kids and from my interactions from the younger generation. We have to remember that Darwin and Isaac Newton, if I'm not mistaken, both developed their incredible theories at 22 years old. Mm. So we gotta make sure that we exploit these phenomenal ideas that maybe we have not thought about, because they bring so much new ideas to the table that, you know, again, makes us even better than what we are now.
Today, I'm delighted to be speaking with Lieutenant General Jenny Carignan, the first Chief of Conduct and Culture of the Canadian Armed Forces. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and you're listening to the CO Series. Next up, we'll ask the General about her experience as a female leader in what has been a traditionally masculine enterprise.
They made it, and they're telling you how. You're listening to the CEO Series with Carl Moore on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
Hello again, you're listening to the CEO Series, and today I'm speaking with Lieutenant General Jenny Carignan, the first Chief of Conduct and Culture of the Canadian Armed Forces.
What is the difference between being in command and being a leader? Because in the military, you're in command, no question about it. You're a 3-star. But what we want to learn is, what is leadership? Mm-hmm. And has it evolved in your thinking over your career?
Like, what I like to say about this is that if you're in command, you can decide to exercise leadership or not.
Okay.
So, like, the processes, the structure, all is there. So you can pretty much run things, you know, it's going to run on their own. We have a lot of people doing a lot of work. So positional leadership, that's what command is.
Yeah.
Now, exercising leadership is a totally different thing. And then you can exercise leadership at all level, even if you don't have any rank. So to me, that's kind of how we can differentiate both of them. So leadership is about providing a vision. It's about a bit like the teacher in the classroom in grade 6. Mm. It's about providing a safe place for people to come together. It's about building teams. It's about creating a positive place. It's about creating space for learning together. It's about creating this environment where people can grow and thrive and actually feel that they contribute and what they do matter. So to me, leadership is a lot about that. So don't get me wrong. if you're in command, it's because you've been assessed and evaluated, but it means two different things. You can exercise leadership at all levels.
Are there any particular leaders that you admire that have been people you look to?
Oh, yes. Angela Merkel. Angela Merkel, why? Because of her absolutely disarming humility, authentic, and with a huge amount of integrity. So to me, like longevity, the 12 years leading a country, like the main country, it's very, very impressive. The second one I would say is Nelson Mandela, that regardless of his almost 30 years in prison, he actually came out of there in a non-punishing way. Mm-hmm. He could have been very negative towards, the white person, like the white proportion of the population. And this is not what he did. Again, he was a leader of everybody and decided to take the country further and make it better, regardless of what his background had been. And then the last one of my favorite, and he has been accompanying me on for the past 20 years, is Marcus Aurelius. To me, Marcus Aurelius has influence, the way he tackled authority and the way he exercised leadership is something to be inspired from. So his book, Meditations, has accompanied me, for the past 20 years. Every time I pick up the book, even if I read it 100 times now, I still learn something new every time I pick up that book.
And that was from what century, do you recall? I'm trying to think what century it was.
Like around 140, 160 was when he actually fought.
BC?
AD. AD, yeah.
Okay.
So he basically, in the year 166, I think he was fighting a pandemic in the Roman Empire,
okay.
which have we invented new in this year?
In class, I talk a little bit about von Clausewitz and then the Chinese writer.
Sun Tzu.
Yeah. Would those be two people that you occasionally look at as well?
Oh, of course. So to me, those are the military thinkers, Jomini, Jacques de Guibert, Clausewitz, Sun Tzu are all military thinkers that, of course, I've enjoyed significantly learn from.
I think my show producer, Gabby Hartshorn-Mell, would like to ask you a question. Gabby?
In your position as the Chief of Conduct and Culture, you are in charge of changing the historically masculine culture of the military. Do you still face challenges as a female leader? What do you think still needs to change in the organization?
Mm-hmm. Well, we do have challenges, of course, in that area because we have been trained and educated, and not just the military, but in society as well, towards certain beliefs. So there are fundamental beliefs that we have that are affecting our behaviors. And we don't see them only in the military, but in society as in general. So I think men do this and women do that usually. And this is still firmly ingrained into our society. I do meet women at times, and it sometimes it's difficult for me because it's as if I was judged as a bad mother. And then I show up to work and, you're not dedicated enough to your work, obviously, because you have kids now. So, which is very unfair because my male colleagues never have to deal with that sort of balance. So this is firmly ingrained in our society. So now take this into the military, where that role has historically been given to men. We also have to remember that within defense, not only within the military, but on the public side, there's hundreds of different things that you can do. There's so many different occupations. It's from the cyber, we call the cyber warriors, to the lab technician, to mechanics who will fix very high-tech level machineries, airplane. Like, there's so many different things. So there is a lot of beliefs that need to be debunked, and this is a bit what we are currently doing, is put a mirror into people's face and say, hey, listen, you know, that belief there, why, like, what does that do to how you behave? How we write assessments. There's, you know, biases ingrained into how we write assessments about women or men or people from racialized background. So we're putting a mirror into people's face to show them that, you know, once you've worked on the beliefs, once you've acknowledged that you have biases, then it's easier to go forward in crafting different ways of doing business.
Do you think globally we are progressing forward? Because in some areas we seem to be, but not so in other cases, such as with Roe versus Wade or in Iran right now.
Yes, I'm so glad we live in Canada.
Yeah.
I've been enough to many places to be extremely grateful for who we are and where we live, and it's the changes will need to be like evolutionary, and sometimes it's one step forward and two steps back. If we take Iran as an example, and they will have to do these changes for themselves. We can't do it for them. Sure, we can influence. We can, you know, come in and remain our authentic selves, and they can see that other models work. But I think slowly but surely, eventually, evolution will take place as well across the world, but not all at the same time and at the same speed.
I'm afraid that's all we have time for today. Thank you very much for joining us, General. I would also like to thank our show producer, Gabby Hartshorn-Mell, our scriptwriter, Stephanie Richet, and our technical producer, Marco Campagna. A la prochaine.
Hello, and welcome to another Producer's Cut edition of the CEO series. My name is Gabby Hartshorn-Mell. I am a student of Professor Carl Moore at McGill and the producer of this show. This week, Professor Moore has granted me the opportunity to share my favorite parts of our newest episode, our interview with Lieutenant General Jenny Carignan. I'm very excited to get started. I want to jump right in with General Carignan's comments on her first experiences with leadership.
I think I probably had the first experience in grade six. Really, I was a school dropout. I decided to quit school in grade six because the climate in my classroom had become toxic. The teacher was basically not managing discipline in the classroom in a proper way, so it became very difficult for any learning to take place. And all of a sudden, you know, I would pick up fights with boys in the classroom. And on a Friday afternoon, I decided I had enough. So I left with two other classmates of mine. And we started to do schools ourselves in my basement at the house. And the difficulty there was that my mother was a teacher in the same school. So you can just imagine the dynamics at home and at school for her. But I only came back when they replaced the teacher.
Wow.
So this is kind of a time when I started to understand that maybe there's ways of doing, you know, things that where I have a little bit of influence.
It honestly seems quite fitting that General Carignan grew up to be a general, since even as a child she had a love for order and discipline. When asked about her role as Chief of Culture and Conduct at the Canadian Armed Forces, General Carignan had this to say.
What, you're the Chief of Professional Conduct and Culture, I believe the first one. What is exactly does a Chief of Professional Conduct and Culture do?
So we created that organization in April of 2021. So it's a year and a half old right now. And this come with the realization that over the many past years, we have built and changed over time in terms of leadership, how we address misconduct, how we address sexual misconducts. But it came to a point last spring when we assessed that we had not gone where we needed to go. And we had a lot of entities within defense that worked culture. So diversity and inclusion, anti-racism, the complaint system, Director General, like the whole gender-based analysis. We have, you know, people who do that. But these many entities did not work in a synchronized and a coordinated fashion because they were spread around our system. So this is what we've done basically is consolidate all of these organizations that have been working culture for many years. And now we are modifying how we interact with the rest of the Canadian Forces and the Department of Defense. So think about CPCC as this platform that constantly monitors change and transformation in our environments. Think about CPCC as the organization that constantly monitors and remain vigilant about work climate and environment.
What stands out to me here is the General's view on systemic change as a key point of her strategy to end sexual and other misconduct. I think this perspective is applicable to any form of systemic change and a lesson to anyone hoping to achieve something along similar lines. Culture within the military, and any organization for that matter, is reinforced by normalized behaviors. Changing these behaviors is a significant challenge, but it is crucial to affect systemic change. Across generations, such a transition can prove difficult, especially if older generations are cemented in their ways. Interestingly, General Carignan also stated that the traditional hierarchical structure of the military is necessary for situations of crisis management.
So when there's a crisis, regardless of the crisis, we come in with people who can adapt to the context, with people who can deploy to very difficult places, with people who can assess, make recommendations, work with the civilian authorities, whether it's provincial or others. So we can come in to support to the police or regardless of what it is. So the way we are also organized enables this to happen. So we are organized in a very hierarchical way. And this is important because it is the best. Again, recalling my MBA studies, yeah. There is no perfect structure in an organization. Some do better in some contexts than others. But when we're talking about intervening in a crisis situation, hierarchical organizations are best enabled to do that because then communication systems, everybody knows what they have to do and so on and so forth. But it doesn't mean that people blindly do whatever. You know, we have a lot of people who think, we have a lot of people who take initiatives, and then the way you operate together is what makes the big difference. So, yeah, we have a very wide variety of roles that we can be employed to, but it's because of those special skill sets that we acquire because we train for worst-case scenarios.
I agree with the General here. The corporate world has adapted to prefer a much more dynamic and creative approach to problem-solving as Gen Z has come into the workforce wanting something different. However, organizations such as the military, at the end of the day, need someone to on top to call the shots and reduce the inefficiency sometimes accompanied by group decision-making. This compromise between total structural top-down and visionary decision-making can be understood as related to Mintzberg's emergent strategy approach. Similarly to what was previously said about norms and behaviors, General Carignan had this to say about difficulties she faces as a female leader in a historically masculine organization.
Mm-hmm. Well, we do have challenges, of course, in that area because we have been trained and educated, and not just the military, but in society as well, towards certain beliefs. So there are fundamental beliefs that we have that are affecting our behaviors. And we don't see them only in the military, but in society as in general. So I think men do this and women do that usually. And this is still firmly ingrained into our society. I do meet women at times, and it sometimes it's difficult for me because it's as if I was judged as a bad mother. And then I show up to work and, you're not dedicated enough to your work, obviously, because you have kids now. So, which is very unfair because my male colleagues never have to deal with that sort of, balance. So this is firmly ingrained in our society. So now take this into the military where that role has historically been given to men. We also have to remember that within defense, not only within the military, but on the public side, there's hundreds of different things that you can do. There's so many different occupations. It's from the cyber, we call the cyber warriors, to the lab technician, to mechanics who will fix very high-tech level machineries, airplane, there's so many different things. So there is a lot of beliefs that need to be debunked. And this is a bit what we are currently doing is put a mirror into people's face and say, hey, listen, that belief there, why, like, what does that do to how you behave? How we write assessments. There's, biases ingrained into how we write assessments about women or men or people from racialized background. So we're putting a mirror into people's face to show them that, once you've worked on the beliefs, once you've acknowledged that you have biases, then it's easier to go forward in crafting different ways of doing business.
As General Carignan puts it later in the show, change is evolutionary. Sometimes it may seem like we take one step forward and two steps back, such as with what is going on in Iran right now. This case is similar to what we discussed earlier, how change must occur within an organization. It must be systemic and it must alter norms and behaviors. This occurs at different paces for every group, but eventually it will occur nonetheless. I think that's a nice way to end off. Thank you very much for tuning in to this mini episode of Professor Moore's CEO series. It has been an honor to share my ideas for you. Thank you very much to Professor Moore for allowing me the space to contribute my thoughts. As always, à la prochaine.